on their academics, not worrying if they're going to get picked up or if someone else who works at a school is going to get picked up. This is not what schools are for. And I've been getting this question throughout the week. We've been working day and night. You know, I'm lucky to work with a team of amazing organizers, lawyers, health advocates, teachers, who for the last few months have been doing everything possible to spread the news about what are people's rights in our communities so that they can get some sense of hope and knowledge in a time that is filled with fear.
Maynai, we're going to give you the last word. You have studied this issue for decades. You're not inside the United States right now, where you usually are. But everything from birthright citizenship to the raids have begun. And the threats to officials if they try to stop these raids, and the idea that schools, churches can be raided by ICE.
I think what we're seeing this week is shock and awe. It's meant to terrorize immigrants in their communities, their families. It's meant to terrorize and make fearful elected officials, leaders of organizations. It's a big shock and awe. How much they will continue to do this remains to be seen. I think they're serious. I think we should be very worried. But it's not clear to me that they can actually deport 11 million people. It's wildly expensive and difficult to do. Can he deport 1 million people a year? Even that's difficult. But they're going to make a big show of this and terrorize our communities. And I think we have to fight on all levels, in the communities, in the courts. And the political and legal situation does not look great for us, I'm afraid, because I think the Supreme Court may very well go along with some of this, both on the 14th Amendment and on the 10th Amendment, which is the amendment that says that states and local governments cannot be forced, cannot be coerced into enforcing federal laws. So we'll see how this goes. I think we should be very concerned and pay close attention.
Maynai, professor of Asian American Studies and History at Columbia University, speaking to us today from Paris, France, and Harold Solis, legal director at Make the Road New York. Coming up, the posthumous pardoning of the Black nationalist leader Marcus Garvey. It was one of President Biden's last acts in office. Stay with us.
Marcus Garvey's words come to pass. Marcus Garvey's words come to pass. Can't get no food to eat. Can't get no money to spend. Oh. Can't get no food to eat. Can't get no money to spend. And you, hello, come, little one, come, oh, let me do what I can, for you and you alone.
Oh. Marcus Garvey by Burning Spear. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Last week, President Biden made history by issuing more pardons and commutations than any president before him. Among the thousands of pardons was one that came after more than a century. Black nationalist leader Marcus Garvey received a posthumous pardon for a mail fraud conviction in 1923. Advocates and congressional leaders had pushed for Garvey's pardon for years, with supporters arguing Garvey's conviction was politically motivated and an effort to silence the Pan-African leader who spoke of racial pride. This is audio of Marcus Garvey speaking in Harlem in 1924.
The Negro is a man. We represent a new Negro. His back is not yet against the wall. We do not want his back against the wall because that would be a peculiar and desperate position. We do not want him there. It is because of this that we are asking for fair compromise. where the Belgians have control of the Belgian Congo, which they cannot use. They have not the resources to develop, nor the intelligence. The French have more territory than they can develop. There are certain parts of Africa in which they cannot live at all. So it is for you to come together and give us a United States of Africa.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
We are not going to be a race without a country. God never intended it, and we are not going to abuse God's confidence in us as men. We are men, human beings, capable of the same acts as any other race, possessing under fair circumstances the same intelligence as any other race. Now, Africa's been sleeping, not dead, only sleeping. Today, Africa's walking around not only on our feet, but on our brains. You can enslave us, was done for 300 years, the bodies of men. You can shackle the hands of men. You can shackle the feet of men. You can imprison the bodies of men, but you cannot shackle or imprison the minds of men.
Born in Jamaica in 1887, Marcus Garvey established the Universal Negro Improvement Association, an African Communities League, in 1914. In 1917, he established the headquarters of the UNIA in Harlem. Black self-reliance was central to his ideology, and he established the Black Star Line, a shipping company which raised over $600,000 before collapsing in 1922. In 1923, U.S. authorities prosecuted and convicted Garvey for mail fraud in connection with the Black Star Line. He served a two-year sentence, was then deported to Jamaica. He died in 1940 in England. For more, we go to human rights lawyer and Howard University School of Law professor Justin Hansford. He's executive director of the Thurgood Marshall Civil Rights Center, the first American to be nominated and elected to the United Nations Permanent Forum for People of African Descent. Professor Hansford is the author of Jailing a Rainbow, The Unjust Trial and Conviction of Marcus Garvey. So, Professor Hansford, you and Howard University were instrumental in achieving this pardon in the last hours of President Biden's tenure. Tell us the story of Marcus Garvey.
Yes, good morning, Amy. This is a pleasure this morning to talk about one of my personal heroes. You know, Marcus Garvey, as you described, was one of the first anti-colonial global Black leaders. He created an organization of over 6 million people. And what he did was do more than simply provide inspiration, but he also provided a blueprint for Pan-Africanism, the creation of the red, black, and green flag. You know, his words, for example, "We will emancipate ourselves from mental slavery," would later be a foundation for the lyrics of reggae music, which were quoted by Bob Marley in images and ideas sent across the globe. And, you know, the parents of Malcolm X were devout followers of Garvey, and that served as an inspiration for Malcolm X's activism and Dr. Martin Luther King. So that the echoes of his work reverberate unto today throughout the Black freedom struggle. And this particular legacy is one that not enough people know about. And one of the wonderful things about obtaining this pardon is to have this conversation this morning. To have the conversation which has taken place over the past week, to be able to, in this time when Black history is being suppressed all across the country, in schools across the country, we have an opportunity now to talk about these ideas around entrepreneurship and, you know, self-confidence and a global lens on activism and liberation, which is, especially in this time where we're facing so many threats on, with our social justice struggles being pushed into a corner. As you just heard Marcus Garvey say, we do not intend to stay in that corner. We intend to fight back. And he's a wonderful example and inspiration of what that fight back must look like going forward.
So, Professor Hansford, can you be specific on his life? Talk about the Black Star Line. Talk about what got him in legal trouble and the political underpinnings of that, what it meant for him to go to jail, why he ended up being deported.
Yes, well, you have to think back to 1920, 1921. The context 100 years ago is we're in the midst of Jim Crow. We're having hundreds of lynchings taking place around the country. Black people are one generation removed from enslavement. And here comes Marcus Garvey with the idea to create a mode of travel and commerce that would connect the Black diaspora in the Caribbean and on the African continent. Remember, At that time, every country in Africa was under colonial rule except Ethiopia. So here's this concept. Many people would use the term back to Africa. But what was meant by his rhetoric was that he wanted to allow people to return back to their spiritual roots on the continent. And in addition to that, think about the concept of independent economic commerce and being able to do for yourself. And so what took place was he created the Black Star Line, which energized the world. And it's hard to overstate, you know, how important this was and how inspirational this was. Young kids on the continent of Africa would read his speeches in his newspapers and memorize the words and, you know, run back to the rest of their community and repeat the words that they had memorized. I mean, this electrified a people around the world that were in the midst of oppression. And at the same time, this was a shipping company created to allow people to trade goods and travel. And at this time, we know that in the early 1920s, we're on the cusp of the Great Depression. It was after World War I, so there were a lot of ships available for this type of activity. And a number of factors made it very difficult to thrive economically with the shipping company as the Great Depression sparked off. But what happened was J. Edgar Hoover, and we know that name as later on in his career at the head of the FBI, he would go on to create COINTELPRO and to harass Dr. Martin Luther King and the Black Panther Party. But he really got his start harassing Marcus Garvey, who we feared would be a quote-unquote Black Moses. And so he led an investigation where he targeted Garvey, the first Black FBI agent named James Wormley Jones was assigned to infiltrate Garvey's Black Star Line. And ultimately, they brought a lawsuit arguing that the entire Black Star Line enterprise and project was just a fraud. And to use the mails to advertise for the Black Star Line was using the mails to defraud. And so they brought that case before an all-white jury in 1923 and convicted Garvey and ultimately imprisoned and deported him. And he would never return to the United States after that conviction. And I just wanted to say what made that conviction so terrible. It wasn't simply a random charge. What they did is they tried to undercut his life's work and say the very thing that inspired millions of people around the world was actually a fake and a fraud. And so it spoke to the heart of his activism and his vision and really tried to delegitimize his life's work. That's what made it so important to overturn that.
In July of 1917, the city of East St. Louis, Illinois, became the scene of one of the bloodiest race riots of the 20th century. Mobs of whites set fire to the homes of Black residents, beat, shot, and lynched men, women, and children. Marcus Garvey spoke out against the violence in an emergency meeting in Harlem, marking the expansion of his movement to include American race relations. This is a clip from Stanley Nelson's PBS American Experience documentary, Marcus Garvey, Look for Me in the Whirlwind. It's an actor reading Garvey's speech.
The whole thing, my friends, is a bloody farce. That the police and soldiers did nothing to stem the murder thirst of the mob is conclusive proof of conspiracy on the part of the civil authorities to condone the acts of the white mob against Negroes. White people are taking advantage of black men today because black men all over the world are disunited.
So that was a reading of Marcus Garvey. Explain the context, Professor Hansford.
Yes, well, what we're talking about in 1923 is shortly after the Red Summer of 1919. We're seeing lynchings happening all across the country and also... they're being framed as race riots. And in this context, there's a debate taking place as to how we should respond in our community. And Garvey and W.B. Du Bois and others were hotly debating this topic. Garvey's position was that we must stand up aggressively and be willing to assert ourselves and be willing to have a global vision, bring people together from around the world to fight back. It's very similar to, I have to say, an inspiration to what we're facing right now. We're in the very dark moment politically, and we have to think amongst ourselves, how are we going to respond? Are we going to respond with confidence? Are we going to respond with a sense of self-empowerment? Or do we feel like we have to cower and take a less aggressive approach? It was very confrontational. It was very courageous in terms of what Marcus Garvey advocated for. And, you know, that's one of the reasons that he was seen as a threat. And that's why he was targeted by the United States government because of his approach and his way of inspiring people to respond and stand up for themselves and really assert their dignity and come up with effective strategies that often demanded that we took an economic-based approach to self-empowerment.
The posthumous pardon for Marcus Garvey is and the same pardon as Ravi Ragbir, the immigrant rights leader. And I encourage people to go to democracynow.org to see our interview with Ravi after he, too, was pardoned. That came out on Sunday. But finally, Professor Hansford, I wanted to ask you about President Trump expanding his crackdown on DEI, diversity, equity and inclusion, revoking a 60-year-old executive order signed by then-President LBJ, Lyndon Baines Johnson, banning hiring discrimination, and talk about overall what has happened with this. DEI workers across the federal government have been suspended as of Wednesday. I mean, it is astounding what's going on. And in the next days, anyone in the federal government is encouraged to rat out others who might be working on disguised DEI issues. Have we seen anything like this before? And what's the significance of it?
Well, you'd have to go back to these periods in history we're talking about to see similar efforts from the federal government. And, you know, I would say that the important thing for us to understand right now is that the constitutional grounds for providing some way of creating inclusion in these institutions has not suddenly disappeared on the grounds of these executive orders. There's a big difference between the Supreme Court and the presidency. And so there's still a pathway forward. And this is connected to the pardon of Marcus Garvey, interestingly, because Garvey's pardon is an example of the process of seeking to repair harms of the past. Many people talk about the push for reparations. And many of these institutions, although the grounds for diversity based on simply an effort to create more inclusive communities for effectiveness purposes may be under challenge, it is still constitutional to create diversity on the grounds of repairing for past harm under the Supreme Court's jurisprudence. So there is a need for us to look back. You know, this is not just symbolic. This is not just academic. The more of our institutions need to look back and acknowledge the harms of the past, because then they can institute these programs as a way to provide remedies for the harms that they were culpable in the past. So these efforts, even though at the first glance, it would not seem that something like a posthumous pardon has particular resonance and relevance to our contemporary struggles, these are intimately connected processes, and we should take the message and use it for our fight going forward.
Justin Hansford, I want to thank you for being with us. Howard University School of Law professor, author of Jailing a Rainbow, The Unjust Trial and Conviction of Marcus Garvey. Up next, Australian journalist Peter Gresty, who was imprisoned by Egyptian authorities, now on hunger strike to free his former cellmate, the jail blogger and activist Ala Abdel Fattah. Stay with us. فإذا استهلكنا لا نحتج دعونا نعشق وطننا العك فإذا استهلكنا لا نحتج ونطوص دماغنا في الحيطة في ستسمر يوما شق الليطة نطوص دماغنا في الحيطة Bakanalak, Homeland at Odds by Mariam Salah. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. The family of the prominent British-Egyptian political prisoner Ala Abdel Fattah is stepping up pressure on the British government to secure Ala's release from prison in Egypt. They've repeatedly called on British officials to prioritize his release above any new trade or economic deals with Egypt and to issue sanctions until Ala is free. British Foreign Secretary David Lammy was in Cairo Thursday, where he met with Egypt's foreign minister to discuss the Gaza ceasefire, Sudan, and other regional issues. Foreign Minister Lammy said on social media, "I repeated my call for the release of Ala Abdel Fattah so that he can return to his family, will continue to raise his case," he said. Ala's mother, the Egyptian-British activist, mathematician, professor Leila Swift, has now been on hunger strike for 117 days. She spoke to Democracy Now! Last month in London.
I'm hoping that my hunger strike will create a crisis for both governments, actually. I'm pressuring both governments. I'm binational, so, and Ala is binational, so I consider that both governments are responsible for him.
British Foreign Secretary Lammy met with Professor Swaif, Ala's mother, in November. He was questioned about Ala's case in the British Parliament last year.
It's of huge concern, and I pressed him to do more. We have continued to do that with the Egyptians. It's obviously sensitive because of the situation in Gaza, but I don't think they're under any doubt how seriously this is taken by the British system, the government, and this parliament.
Ala was due to be released from prison last September after 5 years behind bars over unfounded charges of spreading false news. Egyptian authorities have refused to count more than 2 years Ala spent in pretrial detention toward time served, meaning they won't release him until 2027. Ala has spent most of the last decade in seemingly indefinite imprisonment, separated from his family. For more, we go to London, where we're joined by Peter Gresty, the Australian journalist, professor at Macquarie University in Australia, the executive director for the Alliance for Journalist Freedom. Peter Gresty was arrested on terrorism charges in 2013 while working for Al Jazeera in Egypt. He met Ala Abdel Fattah in prison at the time. Peter was convicted and sentenced to 7 years, but released after 400 days after intense international pressure. He's now joining Ala's mother, Leila Swaif, and is on day five of a hunger strike demanding the British government pressure Egypt for the release of his friend Ala. His op-ed for The Guardian is headlined, "I owe Ala Abdel Fattah my life, which is why I'm going on a hunger strike to help free him." Let's hear from Ala Abdel Fattah in a moment. But Peter, let's begin with you. We only have a few minutes. Explain how you came to know Ala, the fact that his mother, the mathematics professor, is on her 117th day of a hunger strike in London, pressuring the British government, as they're both British-Egyptian citizens, to get Ala out of prison. Tell us who he was and how you knew him, Peter.
So Ala is an extraordinary character. I was in prison. I was in Egypt back in the end of 2013, covering the unfolding political crisis there for Al Jazeera. And I was arrested on terrorism charges. I was thrown into solitary confinement in Limantoura prison. And one of the first voices that I heard when I went in there was Ala's. I was confused. I was scared. I didn't know what on earth was going on, or even much about where I was. I didn't speak Arabic, and so I was very, very disoriented. And Ala reassured me. He explained what had happened, what his understanding was. He told me where I was. He said that I'm amongst friends. And he also gave me some of the psychological tools that I really needed to survive prison. After that period of solitary, we often walked up and down the exercise yard together, and I really got a sense of who he was, an extraordinary thinker, political thinker, and a writer. He gave me masterclasses in Egyptian political theory and history and sociology and so on. you know, he also inspired me to write two letters that we smuggled out of prison that really described my imprisonment as an attack on press freedom rather than as any judicial process related to anything we'd done. And that really framed the campaign that ultimately got me out. And so for all of those reasons, I quite literally owe Allah my life.
So, Peter, you were imprisoned with two other Al Jazeera colleagues, and you got out after a year. Allah was so active in the Arab Spring, in the Tahrir uprising. Why does he continue to be held? And what is the British government saying? Have they met with him in prison? It is their right, as he is a British Egyptian citizen.
So Allah, as you said, was one of the main leaders of the uprising from 2011. He had this extraordinary respect and following amongst ordinary Egyptians. He inspired literally millions to come out and fill the streets in the protest that eventually toppled Hosni Mubarak. And I think that is why the Egyptian authorities are still keeping him there, because he is the most popular, the most recognized political prisoner in the system. And I think they fear his capacity to mobilize people. They fear his capacity to inspire. The charges, as you mentioned earlier on in your introduction, are completely bogus and false news. The British government has made strong words. They've written letters to President Sisi. We've had that meeting from David Lammy, the Foreign Secretary, just yesterday. And clearly, the authorities, the British, believe that they're doing all that they can. But as far as the family is concerned, that's simply not enough. Words or letters and points on agendas are simply not enough. Allah is still in there against Egypt's own laws. The Foreign Secretary, as far as the family is concerned, really needs to be using more robust economic tools to get Allah out. We don't know, at least as far as I'm aware, Allah hasn't had consular access. He hasn't had any visits from the embassy to date. One of the things that we were hoping for was that David Lammy would insist on a visit himself to see Allah, but that clearly didn't happen. So all in all, I think, as far as the family is concerned, it's been a rather disappointing meeting. The British government insists it is making robust representations, but as long as Allah still remains, it seems that it's just not enough.
His little boy growing up without him. His mother did visit him a few weeks ago. And Layla herself, Professor Swaif, is in the 117th day of her hunger fast, and you've now joined her?
Yeah, that's right. She's a remarkably tough, resilient, extraordinary woman. But she is now entering the danger zone. The family have been monitoring her vital signs, and in particular her blood glucose levels. And it seems that in the last few days, they have dropped rather alarmingly. And we believe that she may well be approaching the danger zone. At 117 days into a hunger strike without any food, without any calories whatsoever, it's remarkable that she's lasted this long, but she is increasingly frail, and everyone is desperately worried for her health. But obviously, the whole point of this, as this hunger strike, as we heard from that clip from her earlier in your introduction, is to precipitate a crisis. She does not want to die. This is not a suicide mission from Layla. What she wants is to demand justice. She wants to really put Allah's case at the top of the minds of the Egyptian and the British authorities and make sure that Allah comes home. So
Peter
she's pretty
Gresty,
determined. She's going to stick this out.
We have to leave it there. Peter Gresty, also on hunger strike, Australian journalist in solidarity with Ali Abdel Fattah, will continue to bring you news of his imprisonment or perhaps his freedom. I'm Amy Goodman.
Are you curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, feminism, and activism? Tune in to Rabble Radio on CJSF 90.1 FM to hear the latest news and stories that matter to you. Rabble Radio is the flagship podcast of Rabble.ca.
Broadcasting on the internet and at 90.1 FM from high atop Burnaby Mountain, you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM.